From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, we continue our ongoing coverage of the U.S. attempt at regime change in Venezuela with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua.
The big story, of course, is still what's been going on in Venezuela, because it's still going on.
And the main thing about Venezuela is that, as we were talking about in our last conversation, the government is very much in control of events inside Venezuela. They're currently, I'm not sure if they've ended, I don't think they have. They're currently holding the biggest military exercises the country has ever seen, in an attempt to make sure that the country is ready for any possible invasion,
right.
Some variant on an invasion.
Which is on the table. The president himself has said, I'm not taking anything off the table.
Yeah. And I don't know if you saw today in, I can't remember if it was RT or Hispan TV, but one of those media outlets were reporting that Sergio Lavrov, following up a statement from an earlier statement from the Russian Foreign Ministry, that they believed that the United States had already taken the decision for some kind of military intervention. That was a statement from the Russian authorities last week. Mm-hmm. Just over the weekend, Sergei Lavrov said that the form that this military intervention is likely to take is a kind of camouflage military intervention under the guise of humanitarian aid.
Right.
Now, and that whole area is one that the United States and the United States and its NATO allies, Britain, France in particular, of course, but also Germany, Spain, and the others, and they're expert at manipulating their own domestic opinion using pretexts like humanitarian aid, and of course, the attack on Libya and the intervention in Syria is justified under the doctrine of responsibility to protect, which has very little basis in actually in international law.
Right.
But the in Venezuela, the state line today is supposed to be an important day, but one never knows because one never knows how seriously to take these predictions and threats and ministers coming from the United States government, because the United States government just says what it likes from one day to the next, and
right.
it changes its mind from one day to the next. So
right.
apparently today they'd scheduled a big delivery of humanitarian aid into Venezuelan territory without the authorization of the Venezuelan authorities, using as cover the spurious claim to a presidential authority of this character Juan Guaido.
So we
won't know until the news reports come about what has happened, if anything has happened today. But the constant threat is that some kind of attempt to put in humanitarian aid to gain entry into Venezuela, in effect invading Venezuela, supposedly to deliver humanitarian aid, that is, Sergei Lavrov says that will be the pretext for some kind of military adventure, because United States personnel or other personnel accompanying the aid, if they are in some way attacked by the Venezuelan authorities as they invade Venezuela, trying to deliver on the pretext of delivering humanitarian aid, then the United States will have a pretext to use its own military power.
Yeah, no matter how, I mean, look, there's a million scenarios that they can use for doing this. They can have you know, somebody that's with a group of humanitarian aid workers shoot one of them and blame it on the Venezuelan military. Yeah. They can have, you know, troops inside the little Red Cross trucks that roll out once they get inside. The basic thing this rests upon is a fake. The only things that are, you know, in dire need, to the extent that there are some things that are in dire need in Venezuela, are things that are being sanctioned by the United States or the result of sanctions.
In particular, medicines, of course.
And by the way, they happen to have $1 billion here and $10 billion there that they can draw on anytime they like, except that the banks in London and New York won't give the government their own money. And so, you know, the idea, and to cure this problem, they want to send, I think it was a $10 million, aid package that they were going to have go across this bridge.
$20 million,
okay, which is nothing. And then what you do when you're trying to foment unrest, of course, you create a crisis among the population. There's no milk or toilet paper or whatever there is. And then you hand to your own designated agents piles of toilet paper or medicine or whatever the thing it is that's needed. And now suddenly they're the good guy. Look, Maduro took away your toilet paper here. I've got toilet paper for you, etc.
Right. Yeah, and this modus operandi has a very long history on the part of the United States, and drive countries into the dirt and then turn around and say, well, we can rescue you. Yep. You know, and it's like, you know, you deliberately trip somebody up and then say, well, I could help you up if you do what I want.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
So, and that's, you know, and that, but that has a, and back in the 80s, it was Mozambique and Angola when the United States was supporting the apartheid regime in South Africa.
Right.
In Central America, it was Nicaragua. It's been Cuba for almost 60 years now.
Yep.
You know, and so there's nothing new about that.
Not even the players. Angola. You still got Bolton, for example. You had Bolton in Nicaragua, you know, 30 years ago, and he's back.
Elliot Abrams, from Iran.
Elliot Abrams, yeah.
He was convicted. And I think he was pardoned, wasn't he?
He was, yes, he was pardoned. Anyway,
by George Bush, I think.
Senior.
Anyway, and the thing about that is that neither the United Nations nor the Red Cross are willing to participate in that farce.
Right.
So and there was a report today, I think it was in Telesur or somewhere, whereby the United Nations is actually deepening its relationship with Venezuela's legitimate government and its president, Nicolas Maduro. And you have the Red Cross saying that they are not prepared to take part in the proposed U.S. operation because it's not a genuine humanitarian operation.
Right.
So they now, and whatever you think of the Red Cross and whatever you think of the UN, I don't think very highly of either of those organizations.
Right.
But they are the recognized in generally by the great majority of countries and governments in the world as the legitimate channels for humanitarian aid. And they're turning around and saying they don't want anything to do with the United States initiative because it's not humanitarian.
Right. I mean, as bad as they are, in essence, what they're saying is this is too much even for us.
Yeah. So and that's indicative, in my opinion, Don, that's indicative of a big failure on the part of the United States. They thought that they'd be able to bully and cajole all the usual suspects, including the UN, into supporting what they're trying to do to Venezuela. And so far, they haven't. And that's also part of what we were talking about last week. And because what we were saying last week was that the Venezuelan government continues to be in control of the situation. The economy has not collapsed. And normal life goes on in Venezuela. People go to work, they go to hospital, they go to school, they go to university. Normal life is going on as usual. And all this huffing and puffing by the United States has achieved, inside Venezuela, has achieved absolutely zero. If anything, what it's done is galvanize national opinion against United States policy. I know over the last couple of weeks, there have been at least two polls, and by respected polling companies, and both give well over 80% of the population as stating that they're categorically opposed to any U.S. intervention in the country.
That's right.
And then last week, the Hinterlaces opinion poll company, and I think it was on Friday at the, or maybe over the weekend, they came out with this poll that precisely reflected the result of last year's presidential election. And they precisely reflected the general balance of political support.
Right.
For the respective players in Venezuela's national political life. And in that poll, 57% of people said that they regarded President Maduro as their legitimate president.
Wow.
And I think it was 32% said that they regarded Guaido as their legitimate president. That reflects precisely the balance of political opinion in the country.
Right.
So the great majority, and it's always been like that, ever since the days of Chavez, you know, and it's always been something like 45 to 50, depending on the issue, would always support Chavez or Maduro, and now that Maduro is the president, and around 25% to 35% would support the opposition. It's always been like that.
That's right.
So what has the United States intervention achieved in terms of influencing political opinion in Venezuela? Precisely nothing.
Right, and the context for that also, people have to remember that the bulk of the media in Venezuela is in the hands of the same oligarchs who owned everything before Chavez and Maduro and the Bolivarian Revolution. They still control the bulk of the media. And so the daily harangue on all of these private TV channels in between soap operas and, you know, game shows and stuff, just like here in the United States, the daily harangue is the, you know, the Democratic president, Guaido, and the authoritarian socialist leader, the Maduro, et cetera, et cetera. Just like the U.S. has, bleeding out of the radios and TV sets here. This is drilled into the population's heads. And so that 37%, which is latent in the population anyway, it represents a particular social class, also heavy racial overlays with that too. It's basically the white upper middle class, that's that 37%. They haven't really budged much despite the wall-to-wall media blitz.
Yeah, I think the difference between the United States and Venezuela is that in the United States, the kind of bizarro world, this kind of Alice in Wonderland, back to front, upside down world, that is constantly sold to people in the United States, and there most people seem to buy it.
Yeah,
but in countries like Venezuela and Nicaragua, they don't, because most people know very well who the opposition media represent, they and it's the same in Nicaragua, and the most of the all the printed media and about half of the television media, most of the local radio and cable TV media, and they're all run by the opposition, and people know. They know if they're getting a certain message from, say, Channel 10, they know that that's an opposition message trying to make them string along with what the opposition want. And likewise, they know when they listen to government media that that's the government message trying to persuade them to string along with what the government wants. People are very aware of that.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the situation is in the States, but people seem to be less aware in the United States.
Well, there's more. You've got to, you get people tend to, they'll buy whatever comes out of the box and tolerate a good amount of cognitive dissonance with reality, but certain basic fundamental realities are they speak very loudly inside one's head in the face of propaganda. For example, if you are one of the 2.5 million families that now lives in a brand new apartment that was built by Chavez and or Maduro in Venezuela, where before you were living in a tin shack, you understand what's going on in Venezuela and who's on which side, no matter what comes out of your television. And you have a constituent, 2.5 million families, you're talking 7-8 million people that with that particular personal experience of the revolution, let alone healthcare, let alone infrastructure, let alone education, all these different things that people have had that they never had before and they weren't even considered worthy of having before.
Right. Right. Yeah, I remember when I lived in Ireland. I remember working with some Sinn Féin activists in an impoverished part of Dublin, and they said, if the ruling class here thought that we could do without houses, and there wouldn't be any council housing.
Right.
So that's a universal kind of thing. But one of the phenomena that we see here in Nicaragua and also in Venezuela to some extent as well, is that as people get lifted up out of poverty, as they kind of work themselves out of poverty, thanks to support from central government, their expectations increase.
Yep.
And so, that effect that you were talking about, it exists, but it's sometimes it's not as solid as one might think. And of course, that's what the opposition play on.
Right.
And of course, I know that we're drifting off Latin America and the Caribbean, but I remember very well in the late 1970s and early 1980s, the way Thatcherism and I suppose in the United States it was Reaganism, seduced people was by encouraging them to pull up the ladder on the people that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
And so people who'd achieved a university education were suddenly encouraged to think it became okay under Thatcher to think, well, people don't deserve free university education.
Right, that's right.
So all the people that got their free university education were perfect. They voted for Thatcher because.
Right.
That enabled them to feel superior to
same thing
the people
here.
That would no longer have access to university education. So there are all these kinds of phenomena, socio-psychological phenomena that affect the kinds of developments that are progressive developments that you see in Nicaragua and Venezuela, and they complicate how to maintain the support for the momentum of those programs that are here in Nicaragua radically changed. Nicaraguan society.
Yeah.
And that also is what the United States is playing on with its psychological warfare, of course.
Well, they did that here. See, this is something that there was a point in time when the children of the 60s, quote unquote, and of the civil rights movement and of the anti-war movement went from being groups, and having a sort of a collective perspective on things to being hyper individuals that, personalized license plates, your own apartment instead of collective living arrangements, your own car, working your way up within the system. In other words, they began to disconnect from everyone around them. And so when that happens, your understanding of the norm changes because what you see around you is less populated, basically. So, if I went to university on a scholarship or free tuition, I'm making $50,000 or $100,000 a year now. Well, gee, there's not really a need for university education to be subsidized anymore because I'm making $50,000 to $100,000 a year. That's the norm.
I don't know that anymore that it's not, because I've disconnected myself from everybody while I was busy buying another Mercedes or whatever instead of hanging out with my friends and people, you know? And that there was a cultural shift that was induced through the media across the board, music, film, television, popular culture in every way, that went from a collective mindset, which I guess was used to seduce, to draw us in as a generation, basically, and then turned into like basically atomized. And I think there's a correlation between that atomic view and your understanding of solidarity with others, because you start with yourself and your own position as the norm.
Right. And of course, that, and if you look at places like Argentina, and that is what that kind of phenomenon is what Mauricio Macri played on in order to undermine support for progressive political options represented by people like Cristina Fernández de Kirchner.
Right.
So, you know, and while we're talking about Argentina, maybe it's worth looking at another element of the overall U.S. assault on Venezuela, because what they've done is they're systematically trying to discredit progressive policies. So you'll get slogans like socialism doesn't work. And when I hear that phrase, I think again back to Margaret Thatcher's election campaign in 1979, when she first became prime minister, and their slogan then was Labour isn't working. So they were attacking the Labour government because unemployment was relatively high.
Right.
But once she got in, unemployment tripled.
Right.
Right. So so that's the phenomenon that you had with Mauricio Macri.
Right.
It's the phenomenon that we're seeing in Venezuela, and sorry, not in Venezuela, in Brazil and in Ecuador.
That's right.
And all these governments that got into power on a phony agenda, if they had any defined policies at all, which generally they didn't, immediately turn around and impose extremely right-wing, what are called neoliberal policies, kind of cutting back on government, cutting back on the size of government, cutting back on public sector spending in general, opening up the economy as much as possible to unscrupulous opportunist international capital, and claiming that that's the path to prosperity for the country. And in every single case, it fails abysmally on its ostensible terms. Obviously, as you say, it's very successful in terms of its real agenda. And we're seeing that in Argentina. And as you were saying earlier when we were talking before we started recording, and what the United States has done to promote democracy is ensure that in places like Argentina, Brazil, and Ecuador, and elsewhere, anybody that represents a democratic progressive alternative gets embroiled in the legal system, or if not, imprisoned.
Or bought off in the case of Ecuador.
Yeah, and so see that you can, if you can bear listening to or reading Juan Guaido's speeches and interventions, you see that in his phony rhetoric that he suggests.
Let me just tell you, I don't know if you saw this. I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is important. And if you didn't see this, you need to know about this. Apparently, it's come to light that he went to spend some time in Serbia. Back in 2005, okay. So he actually was being trained by the same, they call it the Soros people, but basically U.S. intelligence, CIA, the troublemakers that foment these things, yeah.
The same here. And here in Nicaragua, from something like 2011 onwards, USAID money hasn't been devoted mainly to agricultural extension and the normal issues that development cooperation is supposed to cover, and it's all been for promoting democracy, which and what does that mean? It means training up thousands of young people to become political activists for the right-wing opposition. And that's what the USAID was spending most of its money on in Nicaragua, to the tune of something like $179 million over the last 4 or 5 years.
What's the population of Nicaragua?
6 million.
How much? 100 and what?
179 million.
Okay. So, it's, no, no, 30,000 or $30 a person.
Right.
Wow.
So and that, so when you if you listen to Guaido, and he manages all that, you know, and here in Nicaragua, the main front person was a guy called Felix Maradiaga, and he's kind of interchangeable with Juan Guaido, and it's exactly the same lies. I mean, Felix Maradiaga is an extremely violent individual who was actually filmed in Managua working with the delinquents and armed activists that were responsible for so much death and destruction here in Nicaragua between May and July last year. And Juan Guaido's a carbon copy of Felix Maradiaga.
Yeah.
And he's somebody who was involved in extremely violent incidents, I think from 2013 onwards, with the extremely aggressive Popular Will, Voluntad Popular Party. And now he's kind of trying to palm himself off as some kind of peaceful, legitimate, democracy promoting angel.
Right.
All the elements that we've been talking about, the abuse of legal and constitutional arrangements that we've seen in Argentina and Brazil and Ecuador, and also to some extent in Colombia, and all those elements are present. The psychological warfare, the threats of military action, and I think you're right, Don, to say that the threat of military action remains very real.
For sure.
In the case of Venezuela, but what form that military action will take, one can't really know. And to me, it's not at all clear that and I've said this from the start when we started talking about the intervention, the current intervention in Venezuela, the latest phase of it, because it's been going on since when, 1999?
Yeah.
This latest phase, I continue to believe that the main question is what kind of defeat the United States will suffer.
Right, that's exactly right. You know, this kind of crazy project may be part and parcel of some realistic thinking along those lines on their part. In other words, they see direction, the historical bend that is behind them, and, you know, where they're headed. And they're trying to figure out what kind of a landing to have, basically, whether it's a soft landing, a hard landing, a high-impact, explosive landing. They seem to be now with Pompeo, who, by the way, is supposed to speak with Lavrov later today, Tuesday the 12th, right. And Bolton and that whole crew, or if Trump reaches back into his campaign rhetoric, which he acknowledged, by the way, in an interview a week ago Friday for Face the Nation on CBS, that I ran on the platform of ending these wars and no more regime change, and I meant it, he said. And the CBS interviewer who was trying to goad him on about Syria and such said, yes, you did. So that's there too. Who knows how that's going to all resolve, but we're going to have to come back to this next week because we're just about out of time.
Okay, Don. Well, thanks for inviting me to talk, and let's see how things develop over the next few days.
Yeah, and maybe we could go a little deeper into what happened there last year in Nicaragua, and draw a couple of maybe take a look and see if we can flesh out some other similarities.
There's plenty of parallels with Venezuela.
Cool. Very good. Okay. Thanks a lot. This is their MO. So we can draw a little picture of it. All right. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Okay. Thanks, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.